Passing this at short notice. Is this switched on?
That's comfortable.
Okay, so we'll have four sections to the talk. First, a bit of motivation, then I'll describe the traditional framework for hidden variables theories and discussion of the Bell inequalities, which I'll use. Then I'll prove the technical results, and in the end we'll try and discuss a bit the meaning of the conditions and compare to other things like the Jones-Clifton theorem, maybe Liggett's inequalities, and modal interpretations. General motivation. It's about the analysis of the conditions that go into the derivation of the Bell inequalities, specifically in the stochastic case. There's the famous factorization condition used by Bell and others, and at least in the philosophical literature, it's standard to analyze it in terms of a conjunction of two conditions called parameter independence and outcome independence. That's Shimoni's terminology, and we'll see them in detail in a moment. In words, what outcome independence means is that given the complete state, including the hidden variables, and given the the details of an experimental arrangement, the Alice's and Bob's experimental outcomes should be statistically independent. And parameter independence says that given the complete state, Bob's outcomes should be independent of Alice's experimental arrangement, and vice versa. The general view is that a violation of parameter independence is really bad because, in principle, that leads to signaling. If you know the hidden variables, jiggle something over here, the probability of the results changes over there. That's really bad. But a violation of outcome independence that could be described as leading to some sort of peaceful coexistence with relativity, because there doesn't seem to be any way of using that for signaling. And
Sorry, just
yes.
restate what was that?
Outcome independence is given the hidden variables and the experimental arrangement, the outcomes are statistically independent. And okay, you can't use it for signaling because if they are statistically dependent, if you don't have any control on the outcome over here, you cannot influence the outcome over there. That's it. A few people have been questioning this general wisdom and saying that violations of outcome independence are not that innocent. And later on, we'll mention Jones and Clifton. Among this lot, but generally there has been the hope that there might be some interesting hidden variables theories that respect parameter independence but violate outcome independence. For instance, Richard Healy, when he was working on modal interpretations, hoped that his proposal would be such a theory. But that didn't work out as hoped. Jeff Boob, in the coda of his book Interpreting the Quantum World, mentions some speculations that some Bell-type stochastic Biebold theories would be of this type, but that's also wrong. So people have been wondering about the possibility of constructing parameter-independent hidden variables theories, but nobody has ever come up with the goods. Why not? So what I want to do today is investigating possibilities and constraints on such putative hidden variables theories. I'll give a partial no-go theorem. So, given one supplementary condition, which may be thought of as some kind of locality condition as well, we'll talk about that. Such hidden variable theories will be severely constrained. In what sense? That any hidden variables theory that makes non-trivial predictions, that is, predictions other than the ones of quantum mechanics, for maximally entangled states in dimension 3 by 3 or higher, will violate either parameter independence or this supplementary condition. That's going to be the main result.
So you're saying you leave the one thing that's left open is that the hidden variables exactly reproduces the quantum.
Yes. Well.
So that's good.
No. I mean, for every value of the hidden variables lambda, it's just equivalent to quantum mechanics. Yeah. Usually, one thinks of a hidden variables theory as, oh, here is a more precise specification of the state. If we knew the hidden variables, we could improve on the statistical predictions of quantum mechanics. No. Even if we knew the hidden variables, we couldn't improve on the statistical predictions of quantum mechanics. It's that kind of restriction. So they're trivial, in a sense. Idle baggage, metaphysical baggage. I was actually somewhat uncertain about my title, whether this should be thought of a no-go theorem. But any no-go theorem actually tells you also what things are possible by violating the assumptions of the no-go theorem. So in a sense, what we'll be doing today is also characterizing hidden variable theories that satisfy parameter independence. Let's sketch the general framework of hidden variables theories that we'll use here. I mean, that's something which many of you just have seen too much of, but never mind. So we have a quantum state rho, and now we consider, we suppose that there are other variables in addition to quantum state rho which are relevant for making predictions. These variables are still unknown or uncontrollable in some way, conventionally called hidden. One will consider statistical predictions based on a complete state, which is a pair of the quantum state rho and some lambda. Now, given lambda and an experimental context, one has probabilities for results of measurement results, and we can limit ourselves to considering PV measurements. We won't need anything more general. So we'll have probabilities of the form, where A is the eigenvalue of some self-adjoint operator, and it's very important to consider explicitly experimental contexts, because there are all kinds of results of no-go theorems ruling out or constraining very strongly hidden variables theories that are non-contextual. There's some ambiguity, of course, in the choice of lambda and I. But one which will be largely irrelevant to our purposes today. So, for instance, one could say that I just consists of macroscopic settings, anything that can be controlled explicitly about the experimental arrangement. So that lambda will include also any microscopic variables of the apparatus, any hidden variables of the apparatus, if there are any, any variables hidden or not in the environment. That's one choice of carving up things. Or one could and this is Shimone's choice. Or one could include here macroscopic settings plus all the microscopic variables of the apparatus, any hidden variables in the apparatus, the state of an environment, blah 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 blah. This is, for instance, Jarrett's choice for the people who know the philosophical literature. It's this distinction, this ambiguity is not going to be relevant for our purposes. The only thing that we really will need to assume about I is that it's separable. So we'll include in the experimental context only things that can be separated into Alice's context and Bob's context. If there are holistic hidden variables of the apparatus or in the environment or something like that, let us count that in together with lump that together with lambda. So the kind of things we should think of in terms of the experimental context will be, in particular, say if Alice is measuring self-adjoint operator A and it's not maximal, and any set of observables that commute with A, which Alice might be measuring together with A. And then details of how the apparatus is actually set up. If we're doing spin measurement, we've got different equivalent ways. We can switch the polarity of the magnets. That's a different macroscopic arrangement for measuring the same observable, and that's a context which is very important, say in modeling the experiment using the Bohm theory. The answer does depend on that in the Bohm theory. So that's what we should think of as an experimental context. Right. Now, there's going to be a statistical distribution over the hidden states lambda. And this one, in general, will depend on the quantum state, but one needs to assume, one usually assumes that it is independent of the experimental context I. So this can be cashed out in various terms. No conspiracy. There's no common cause that correlates the settings with the hidden variables, or no backwards causation. It's not possible to choose the settings in the future, and that will influence the hidden variables in the past. It may be very well worthwhile to relax some of these assumptions, in particular the no backwards causation one. Working in Sydney at the Centre for Time, that's a very natural thing to think about. But today we will adopt the traditional framework, no backwards causation. So we're going to have a statistical distribution over the lambdas, which depends on rho. So let's write it rho of lambda, and it's independent of I. These are the standard assumptions. Finally, it is required that averaging over lambda gives us back the quantum mechanical probabilities. So the quantum mechanical probability is going to be integral of p rho lambda IA rho of lambda d lambda. And notice that as part of this requirement, if one averages over lambda, the dependence on the context drops out. So this is the standard framework of hidden variables theories. And now let me just state the various conditions which I mentioned. So suppose Alice measures some observable A with values A, Bob measures some observable B with, and B is the variable describing the eigenvalues. Now, outcome independence is the requirement that the probability given rho and lambda and Alice's context I and Bob's context j of A and B is equal to the probability given rho and lambda and I and j of A times probability of rho lambda ij of B. So this just, given this probability measure, it's just the independence of the outcomes. Yes?
By that equation, the bottom of, yeah. So I can include the instance setting, so what is meant by P sub rho of A without the I?
So, we are fixing the fact that, we are measuring a certain observable A with certain eigenvalues small a. And so that's fixed. What can vary in terms of the context is how we measure it. Say, we measure A together with other observables that commute with A, or we measure A with a certain arrangement of magnetic fields, or we measure A painting the knob of the apparatus blue or red.
So on the left, you could write something like P super A with a capital A.
The probability in the state rho, given that we are measuring the observable capital A, forgetting the results small a. Yes. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's outcome independence and parameter independence is the requirement that the probability for an outcome B, say, is probability for any of Bob's outcomes is independent of Alice's setting, and vice versa, probability for any of Alice's outcomes is independent of the measurement context used by Bob. And from these two, one can derive, these two are equivalent to the factorization condition, which one just substitutes parameter independence into outcome independence and gets Pi rho lambda of A times Pj rho lambda of B. And from this condition, standard ways one derives the Bell inequalities.
Just a comment here.
Yes.
Parameter independence, of course, makes mathematical sense at operational level, where you just plug in this is the setting and that's the outcome. But for a hidden variable theory, which we like the more fundamental description and not an operational description of nature, what is so special about the polarizers that you could sort of factor those out? In the end, there's going to be other material, other atoms describing the outcome. Mm-hmm. why are you now, I mean, what is it that makes those aspects so special that you can factor those out, but not the outcome atoms?
Yeah, well, I've already said that, yeah, there's a certain ambiguity in, you know, how you choose to define I. You know, I'm rather partial to the choice of anything that's macroscopic and controllable for I, and you know, that's an interesting choice because then if we look at the dependence of various probabilities on the things that are controllable, okay, I mean that gives us insight into the possibility of signaling across the experiment and so on, but yeah, there is nothing fundamental about it.
Yeah, but also in the if one wants to make a precise in the variable theory, there has to be something special about those variables. I mean, you have to, you know, mathematically there has to be something distinct with the things you call outcomes and the things you call.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree. I mean, this thing here that doesn't tell us how the outcomes are produced, and how outcomes are represented. This doesn't give us any mechanism. No, this doesn't solve the sort of the measurement problem. No, we are assuming that there's some kind of theory that will give us well-defined distributions for outcomes. In some way, and these are general considerations about such theories, has nothing to do with actually constructing a detailed model like the Bohm theory, where you construct pointers out of particles, and these particles move and show an outcome this way or that way. No, this is a completely abstract discussion. And I completely agree, but it's useful for its purposes.
And also another column, the outcomes could be composed of the same physical variables as the parameters. You could choose to reveal the outcome in the polarized, for example, in the final sentence.
Yep.
So it becomes a little bit strange to say that we have the right to factor out one thing but not the other, because these could be exactly the same variables. Suppose I have a Bell experiment and I say, here's the settings, these are my polarizers, those are described by positions or fields or whatever I have. And in the end of the day, after the experiment, the polarizer is going to go to the left if it's spin plus, or to the right if it's spin minus. Why is it then that I have to, that I am allowed to factor out the settings in the first case when it's a setting? So I factorize those physical variables in the first case. But when it starts revealing the outcome, I'm not allowed to do that.
The important thing is that the distribution of the hidden variables is independent of the settings.
In my construction now, the settings are the same variables as the outcomes.
Yes. Where are the hidden variables?
I mean,
this condition doesn't talk about the outcomes. It talks about the settings and the hidden variables.
The point I want to make is that this distinction seems, you can probably do it in a fundamental theory, but it could be damn hard to do.
Yeah, I mean, you need to do it on a case-by-case basis. You give me a hidden variables theory that solves the measurement problem. Okay, now we need to analyze it, see how it works, it may conform to this model to this abstract description, or it may involve backwards causation or something like that, and then you can't analyze it like this. Okay.
You can't put the Bohm interpretation in this setting, I think, as long as you're preparing a space of pure example state of the source.
I mean, lambda, position of the particle.
Well, lambda is both the position of the particle and the wave function of the field.
Well, in my notation, that's rho. Rho is a quantum state, or psi, and lambda is the additional stuff.
Rho is also the distribution.
I've used rho as I've called the distribution of the lambda rho because the distribution of the hidden variables does depend on the quantum state. I could have called it anything else, but just to emphasize that it depends on the quantum state. It's in the Bohm theory, it's mod psi squared.
One possibility is where lambda is just the quantum state, and then rho is the adult function on the.
Then lambda would be the set of lambdas would be the empty set. Then we've just got rho. Or in fact, lambda is equal to rho itself. I mean that's a trivial. Lambda is equal to rho itself for values of lambda. That's the kind of thing we are going to see. In fact, okay. Thank you very much. So, right. Okay. So. Violation of the Bell inequality implies either implies a violation of parameter independence and or a violation of outcome independence. And what we're going to discuss is the possibility of looking at hidden variables where parameter independence is satisfied and only outcome independence is violated. Okay, so that's a framework. Now let's get to work. So let's consider maximally entangled states on Hilbert space of dimension n times n with n equals 3 or larger. And by the way, by restricting to an appropriate subspace, all results will generalize to entangled states of maximal rank on dimension m times n with m and n both larger than 3. So we're going to have states of the form 1 over the dimension, sum over I, psi I, phi I, and orthonormal basis. Since now we fixed the state, I'll start dropping the index rho from all the formulas. And of course, it's very well known that any choice of basis here will lead to an expansion of the state of the same form. There are infinitely many pairs of observables A and B for which the results of the measurements will be perfectly correlated, which means there's a one-to-one correspondence between the eigenvalues of these observables such that according to quantum mechanics, probability of A is equal to the probability of A and B is equal to the probability of B. Now, let's investigate the consequences of imposing parameter independence. So let's assume that there is an observable A such that for some value Pij lambda of A is different from Pi prime j lambda of A. So we are varying Alice's local context and the probability of the outcome is going to change. Okay, now, in order for the hidden variable theory to reproduce the perfect correlations of quantum mechanics, we also have to have perfect correlations for each individual lambda. So we're going to have Pij lambda of A equals Pij lambda of A and B equals Pij lambda of B. Yeah. Is that obvious? Because if there is one, even just one value of lambda where this is false, then by averaging, we won't be able to get back the perfect correlations. Okay, but now, if we assume that there's a dependence on the local context, well, then because of this, we'll also have that Pij lambda of B is different from Pi prime j lambda of B. And this violates parameter independence. So if we impose parameter independence, we also have to have non-contextuality at the level of the local probability assignments. Right. By the way, this holds for arbitrary dimensions. We don't need dimension 3 to get this. The reason why we are focusing on dimension 3 or higher is because, of course, once we have non-contextuality of probability assignments for quantum mechanical measurements, we can use Gleason's theorem. And
what has been imposed to the bottom equation or the top equation?
It was a reductor, so let's assume that this is different for some A and some pair of context I and I prime. Because of the perfect correlations, this is going to be different, but this is a violation of parameter independence. So we impose that this, we impose that one, and implies non-contextuality. Yeah. So if now we apply Gleason's theorem, we get our first result, theorem one. Take maximally entangled states in 3 times 3 or higher. If we impose parameter independence, then the marginals of the hidden states are density matrices in some convex decomposition of the reduced states. So this is an interesting result, but it's not surprising. In the 80s and early 90s, lots of people have been using the perfect correlations of the spin one singlet state in conjunction with the Koch and Specker theorem to derive restrictions on hidden variables theories. So Haywood and Redhead, Alan Stairs, Harvey Brown and George Svetlichny, and myself, we all did that kind of thing. This is the same idea, but using Gleason's theorem instead. So it's rather unsurprising. In fact, it's rather surprising that nobody did it before. It's probably the kind of thing that if you mention it to many people, they thought of it, but so forth. Okay, now let's go for something new. Let's take the following condition, which I'll call conditional parameter independence. And what is conditional parameter independence? So it's going to be like parameter independence. So the probability I j of b, a certain probability is going to be for the result of Bob's measurement going to be independent of Alice's context. But now this is the conditional probability of B given the result A.
I'm not sure if I understand this claim. The marginals of the hidden states, which are hidden states, you're saying they're equivalent to density matrices?
By Gleason's theorem. OK. So we said the. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Good. Okay. So, conditional parameter independence. So that's a statement of the condition. So formally, yeah, it's very similar to parameter independence, but it's logically independent. So we can imagine cases in which parameter independence is violated, but we have conditional parameter independence. So let's say we've got probability of B given ij and lambda, that's sum over A probability ij lambda B given A times probability lambda of A given ij and lambda. And now, if we impose conditional parameter independence, this thing is going to be independent of I. But we can have cases in which the probability for Alice's results does depend on the local context. So we could very well have dependence on I here. And so we would have dependence of Bob's result on Alice's context, a violation of parameter independence, despite the fact that we've imposed conditional parameter independence. Or we could have parameter independence, but a violation of conditional parameter independence. So again, the probability of B summing over the conditional probabilities times these, and now it could be that we do have dependence on I in here, but it could be that it washes out when we average over the different outcomes A, and that it disappears from the unconditional probability. That may be weird, but certainly possible. And we'll discuss. No, we can discuss this condition a bit later. Intuitively, it seems like a locality condition. Like Jones and Clifton called it constrained locality rather than conditional parameter independence. In that, it seems it seems to be doing the following. Let's fix all other parameters and variables. So let's fix Bob's experimental arrangement. Let's fix lambda. Let's fix the variable A. Okay, and now this seems to rule, well, it does rule out any dependence of B on I, dependence of Bob's result on I's, on Alice's settings, when everything else is held fixed. And, you know, intuitively, that would seem like a good locality condition. There's no influence, no direct influence from Alice's settings to Bob's results. But notice, this is not something that can be cached out in terms of signaling, because we can imagine situations in which that this putative influence of Alice's settings on Bob's results disappears on average. And as we have seen, you know, parameter independence implies that that there's no local context dependence of the results. So Alice couldn't possibly influence her own outcome, and so use the conditional dependence to signal. So it really looks like you cannot cache this out in terms of signaling. Right, now let's impose both parameter independence and conditional parameter independence. What have we then? Okay, so let's consider a piece of lambda ij of A and B, the joint probability. This is equal piece of lambda ij of B given A times P lambda ij of A. And this is also equal to piece of lambda ij A given B times piece of lambda ij of B. Now, okay, we can rewrite these two. Well, first of all, we know that the marginals are non-contextual. So we have, there's one small step which I omitted. By the argument we gave, we saw earlier, we saw that P of A cannot depend on the local context, because through the perfect correlations that would translate into the dependence of B on Alice's context. But by direct application of parameter independence, the probability of Alice's results cannot depend on Bob's context either. So it's independent of both contexts. So that thing there is P sub lambda of A without any indices determining the context. And that thing there, by conditional probability independence, is independent of the context I. So we've shown that this thing is independent of I, but same thing, this is also independent of either context, and this, by conditional parameter independence, is independent of J. So we've shown that this thing is also independent of J. So it's independent of either I or J, and we have shown that if we impose parameter independence and conditional parameter independence, the joint probabilities for results of bipartite measurements determined by the hidden states are non-contextual. Okay, so Theorem 2, under the same conditions, if we impose parameter independence and conditional parameter independence, then they're joint. Probabilities are given by the hidden states are non-contextual. Okay, now we've got some non-contextuality of probabilities. We'd like to apply again Gleason's theorem, but we can't apply the original Gleason theorem. Why not? Because these are only probabilities for results of bipartite measurements. We don't have probabilities for the entangled measurements. So we cannot use the original Gleason theorem on the tensor product. But there are suitable generalizations of Gleason's theorem for the case at hand. Chris is the author of one of them. In fact, they're all the same generalization found by several authors. And the results, well, what the theorem, the generalized Gleason theorem says is that non-contextual probability measures of this kind have the form trace lambda P tensor Q, where lambda is self-adjoint, normalized, but not necessarily positive. So it's going, any expression of this kind with a product projection there is going to be positive, but trace of lambda P could be negative if P is not a product projection. This is fine because what we're talking about is probability measures over product for product observables. And that's it. These are probability measures for product observables. We don't care about whether they extend non-contextually to other observables. We might care about extending them contextually to other observables if we are in the business of constructing a hidden variables theory. And it may be rather non-trivial, even if we can find hidden states of this form, to extend these probability measures contextually now to non-product observables. But we don't need to worry about that, because now we'll show that it is impossible to find hidden states. Now that we've got the form of the hidden states, we can show that there aren't any, or that lambda has to be identical. All lambdas are just going to be identical to the quantum state. And that's going to be our main result.
So theorem 2 says,
all the
localized measurements on Allison Bob's side.
Yes.
There's a non-contextuality property.
Yes.
For the probability distributions.
And yes.
And then use this variation of Gleason's theorem to get that one has these PPT states, positive on.
Yes. Okay. So, so little lambda, the little lambdas in fact correspond to big lambdas.
Okay. So does that imply then that that's only a partial use of PI plus CPI, and now you're going to use it more extensively and show that lambda is...
I don't need to invoke PI and CPI further. This is the work that they do. And what I'm going to show you now is that there are no non-trivial decompositions of a maximally entangled quantum state in terms of these PPT states. And that's something I struggled with for about 2 months and got only partial results. I talked, I was on email with Alex Wilson, Howard, and yourself. And Alex was the one who gave me feedback and said it was a hard problem. And then last weekend, some of us were in Maryland for conference, saw Howard and Alex, and over lunch on Saturday on the tablecloth, they managed to prove this result for me. It turns out to be much simpler than any of us thought. And now I'll show you how it goes. So most of what follows is, it's essentially Howard and Alex, and then I worked out a couple of details that I didn't understand over lunch.
Is it worth maybe just expanding a little bit on this point? So the set of lambdas is a convex set.
It is, yes.
And you have a particular state, psi, that's the maximally entangled one.
Yes, of course, the quantum states are a special case of these PPT states.
So since it's a pure state, it's an extreme point on the convex set of quantum states.
Of quantum states, yes.
But it might not be an extreme point on this other convex state.
Yes, because now we've got more states. We've got more states now, so it could be that this pure quantum state, although it has no non-trivial decompositions in terms of other quantum states, has non-trivial decompositions in terms of these more general states. But no, that's not true. At least if the state is maximally entangled, it's pure also, it's extremal also in this larger convex set. And Alex seemed to be confident that he could extend the result also to arbitrary pure quantum states, not just maximally entangled ones. But
Alex's original intuition came from the fact that we tried for a long time to characterize the extreme points of the sets of lambdas, and we couldn't do that. But you have now a very special state, and so this isn't a complete characterization of all extreme points. It just says, for this one point, we know it.
Yes, any maximally entangled state, that is an extremal point of this larger set. And Alex thinks he can generalize this to any pure quantum state. He thinks any pure quantum state, in fact, is an extremal. But he didn't try that out. I haven't seen whether that really works. Okay, so the proof is in two steps. So we've got two lemmas to prove. So note first of all, if we have a state of this form, it can always be rewritten like this, where phi is a positive a positive affine map on the positive operators. So the intuition is phi of q is the reduced state, which Alice needs to use if Bob has made a von Neumann measurement of Q. And let Bob do all possible von Neumann measurements, look at the collection of all the states which Alice needs to use for her measurements, and that's an equivalent characterization of the state. And let me see. Furthermore, the mapping phi is normalized in the sense that trace phi of the identity is 1. Yes, I said it's positive because, in fact, it maps. You know, this thing is a state for Alice, so it has to be positive. You know, it starts with projection operators, which are positive and span the set of all positive operators, and it gives you something positive. So it's a positive map. It's affine, because it's going to be linear, so it is affine, and this just means that the state that it's going to be a state for Alice. One more thing we need to know is the mapping from the lambdas to the phis is in fact an affine mapping. If we take a mixture of different states lambda, we'll get the corresponding mixture of states of corresponding mixture of mappings, it's 1-to-1. Okay, if we've got different states, the states lambda here, we'll get different mappings phi.
There isn't.
So, okay, so we've got, so what this is, so Q, so this is a mapping from operators, positive operators in Bob's space to positive operators in Alice's space. We can do this with just one-dimensional projectors, and then the rest will follow. If Bob measures a projection onto a given state, that will induce a state on Alice's side. It's a collapse. You know, it collapses the state onto Alice's side, and Alice is going to use some collapsed state on her Hilbert space to calculate the results of her measurements. And this is that beast. Okay, now. Sorry?
It's not linear?
It is.
You called it affine.
Well, affine, I mean, that's what we are interested in. Affine.
It's more than affine, it's linear.
Yes.
Would you just care about the affine?
Yes. Linear implies affine, but what we'll need is that it's affine. So, two lemmas. By the way, how am I doing for time?
1 hour. Mm-hmm. This will go up to about 1 hour and 15.
Okay. Right. So, lemma one. Mm. So any, so if psi is maximally entangled, so now we're going to represent psi in this way, the corresponding phi is an automorphism of the positive cone L plus of H. So a positive and affine mapping of on the positive operators is a homomorphism of the positive operators, and an automorphism is positive and affine, has an inverse, and the inverse is also positive and affine. So that's lemma one. And lemma two is if alpha is an automorphism of the positive cone, and is normalized, trace alpha of the identity is one. And if we try and decompose it as lambda beta 1 plus 1 minus lambda beta 2, and beta 1 and beta 2 are homomorphisms of the positive cone, both with trace beta I of identity equals 1, then, well, there's no such non-trivial decomposition. Beta 1 equals beta 2. I mean, maybe I'll go a little quickly on this, so we've got time to discuss a bit the meaning of the conditions, compare with other things. So what you do to prove lemma one is you consider the bounded operators as themselves a Hilbert space with the Hilbert-Schmidt scalar product, so the scalar product trace of A star B, and a positive cone can be characterized in terms of the Hilbert-Schmidt scalar product. And then you show that if you take the mapping corresponding to a maximally entangled state, this mapping is a unitary mapping of the operators on H, of the space of operators on H to itself, unitary with respect to this scalar product. It follows that it is an isomorphism of the positive cone. Maybe in the interest of time, I mean, it's just checking explicitly, constructing this phi, and then plugging it into the Hilbert-Schmidt scalar product, and seeing that it preserves scalar products. From that, lemma one follows. So I think.
There's something a little wrong with that, because I know that if this automorphism is to just take the transpose with respect to a fixed basis that's set by the maximally entangled state. So when you write down what you mean by the maximally entangled state, chooses an orthonormal basis on Alice's side and an orthonormal basis on Bob's side. And this automorphism is to just take the transpose with respect to that basis. So take Q, so phi on Q is
well, if it is the transpose, that does
a unitary operation.
I mean, the scalar product is preserved by unitary and anti-unitary operations.
Yeah.
So it preserves the scalar product.
Yeah. Indeed, but you said unitary.
Okay, unitary in the sense of unitary or anti-unitary. Okay, it preserves. Okay, it preserves the scalar products. Okay, good. Okay, just writing that explicitly, checking it. Oh, let's leave that. Lemma two. I might write down quickly just for interest because that's the crux of the matter. So, proof of lemma two. So let's take.
Can you repeat the statement of lemma two?
Okay, if alpha is an automorphism of the positive cone, normalized, it cannot be decomposed non-trivially as a convex decomposition of two normalized homomorphisms. Okay, so these are mappings of the positive cone on itself. So let's take let P be an element of the positive cone that generates an extremal ray in the cone. Since alpha is an automorphism, alpha of P also generates an extremal ray. But alpha is supposed to have that decomposition, so we have that. But this generates an extremal ray, so we don't have a non-trivial decomposition. What we have is that beta 1 of P is proportional to beta 2 of P, with some proportionality constant which may depend on P. But beta 1 and beta 2 are both affine, so C of P is a constant, and beta 1 and beta 2 are both normalized, so this constant is 1. So beta 1 equals beta 2, and we prove the lemma. So translating back into the language of states, we have a pure quantum state, maximally entangled. By our corollary of theorem 2, we knew that if our hidden variables theory satisfies parameter independence and conditional parameter independence, any hidden states must have the form of these generalized density operators. But we've just shown that there is no non-trivial decomposition of a maximally entangled quantum state in terms of such hidden states. And that proves our main result. If we take a hidden variables, if we take a maximally entangled state in 3 by 3 dimensions or higher, there's no hidden variables model that satisfies both parameter independence and conditional parameter independence that will improve on the predictions of quantum mechanics. There's no non-trivial decomposition of psi into hidden states. That's our main result. Okay, so our last section, few bits of few miscellaneous remarks. As I said, I was a bit uncertain about the title for this talk, because on the one hand, we can talk about a no-go theorem, that lies in a certain tradition, the tradition. in the philosophical literature, that's the tradition against experimental metaphysics. That was the title of Jones and Clifton's paper, and a recent piece of work along these lines, the PhD thesis by Soizig Le Bihan, which we both examined in Nancy in February, and it's her thesis that that set me off thinking. In fact, it was talking to her a couple of years ago that first made me think of the question of whether there are any hidden variables theories that non-trivial that satisfy parameter independence, and then it was reading a thesis that I started actually working on this. On the other hand, of course, one can read any impossibility theorem as a possibility theorem, which suggests exploring certain possibilities for hidden variable theories, and we can see what we are carving out the various possibilities for hidden variable theories that satisfy parameter independence. They may be weird possibilities or severely constrained possibilities, but we are mapping them out, while until now we have absolutely no idea. So let me just make connections with a couple of things. Maybe I'll have to choose. So there's the Jones-Clifton theorem. Does anyone like to hear how this connects to Jones and Clifton's results? There are the Leggett inequalities how this compares to that. Carving out the possibilities of various hidden variable theories along these lines. Any takers for any of those?
I wouldn't mind hearing about the Leggett thing, but you probably should continue in 5 minutes.
Yes, that's very short. What Leggett did was give inequalities constraining some hidden variable theories. That it's all in 2 by 2 dimensions. With marginals, so the hidden states have marginals given by pure quantum states, and then there are arbitrary joints, and by imposing positivity, he obtains some inequalities have to be satisfied by these theories and are usually violated by quantum mechanics. And the other day in Maryland, we heard those who were there. We heard from Gisin about some very recent generalizations, a paper in Quant PH, January of this year. Generalizing that to sort of marginals that are mixed states, he was telling us. The indications are, the lesson of that is that in 2 by 2 dimensions, the only way to reproduce perfect correlations is with hidden states which have flat marginals, which have the quantum mechanical marginals, half the identity. In a sense, this doesn't give us inequalities, doesn't give us quantitative results, but in a sense, this is stronger, now in 3 by 3 and higher, that tells us that if we want to reproduce perfect correlations, the hidden states don't just have to have the quantum mechanical marginals, but the hidden states are identically equal to the quantum state. That was less than 5 minutes, I bet.
Is that the end?
Yeah. The end of this. If you want to hear some other remarks. Okay, you may clap. Thank you.
This is a very interesting result. I recall that in Bell's original paper, course, he used perfect correlations in deriving his, for the first version of his inequality. And then, you, as you know very well, people like Shimoni and others thought, well, wouldn't it be nice if we could not appeal to perfect correlations or anti-correlations? I never fully understood the argument, but it was felt much better if you could derive an inequality which didn't appeal to the strict correlations or anti-correlations. And I'm just wondering how you feel. I mean, if Shimoni was here, he'd probably raise this point and say, well, that's nice, but...
As the result stands, at both crucial junctions, I rely on maximal entangled states. In theorem one, when I use the perfect correlations to translate parameter independence into non-contextuality, I rely on the perfect correlations, and you cannot relax that.
Did you actually use that thing to get your main theorem? I thought that was an aside.
I did use it because to derive the non-contextuality of the joints, you need to have non-contextuality of the conditional probabilities and non-contextuality of the marginals.
Okay.
This you get by parameter independence, and this you get by conditional parameter independence. So those two conditions are absolutely crucial. It's a very direct characterization, very, very, very simple. I mean, you can't take out anything, and it's very direct the way that it gives you this non-contextuality. For lemma one, I use maximal entangled states. If Alex is right and this holds for arbitrary pure states, then the only place where I really use maximal entanglement is for that theorem one. But you really can't do without. If you relax that, then you have only the Barth orthogonal decomposition to play with. You generally have just one basis in which you have perfect correlations, and that may perfectly well be non-contextual.
I wasn't so much considering. Mm-hmm. I mean, worried about the maximal entanglement. I was more worried just about the fact that perfect correlations for certain.
No, I mean, I need perfect correlations for all. Take an arbitrary observable over here.
Right.
I need to have a perfectly correlated one somewhere else. If I don't have that, then I could allow for contextuality for some observables that are not perfectly correlated with anything, which are not perfectly correlated with another orthonormal basis, but with something else, and then probabilities can go all over the place. You don't get any non-locality. You can't prove that you get non-locality out of that contextuality. So if the probability assignment to the elements of the bi-orthogonal decomposition are non-contextual, you don't get problems there. That's the only requirement then. Anything else can be contextual, and you don't get any non-local consequences.
Bon,
Bohm theory is in a completely different category. It violates parameter independence. You can signal using, if you know the particle positions, you change the polarity of the magnetic field in a Stern-Gerlach experiment, instead of going down, this particle will go up. It violates parameter independence very, very heavily. In fact, any deterministic hidden variables theory trivially satisfies outcome independence. So any deterministic hidden variables theory that, in fact, reproduces the violations of the Bell inequalities has to violate parameter independence.
And A is not low, sorry, because A is so normal quantity that I do not get some forms. But it's not a real hidden variable theory.
The Bohm theory, I mean, is a hidden variables theory, can be described in these terms, with the general framework of hidden variable theories. Lambda is just then the position of the particle, but in terms of which conditions it satisfies or violates, satisfies outcome independence and violates parameter independence. And here I was looking at the exact opposite. What can we do if we satisfy parameter independence and violate outcome independence?
Well, this property of the Bohm allows it as describing the things.
It reproduces the violations of the Bell inequalities.
Mm-hmm. It's allowed for describing the things because you say, I'm
sorry, but yeah, yeah, the Bohm theory. Yes, uh-huh. Certainly.
The same Bohm description could enter also as a lower theory.
It's perfectly fine. I mean, the problem is because it violates parameter. According to many people, the problem is because it violates parameter independence, it's incompatible with relativity. Yeah, that's the main problem for many people. There's an expert right here, there's another expert right there. And another expert right there. So. And the fourth one. You're surrounded by Bohmians.
Most of these conditions that originally went in, like the what you called outcome independence, they all trace to some assumptions about causality. That's the most physically interesting way of motivating them. So I don't have exactly a definite question, but is there some way, I mean, you've dropped some, you've kept others. Mm-hmm. Can you characterize what you've done in terms of some modified causality?
I can try. I mean, it's tricky. So it's pretty clear that parameter independence is just the no signaling condition. So that's pretty clear.
At the level of, yes.
No signaling condition. Yeah. If we knew the hidden variables, can we signal or not? Whether or not we can, that's exactly where the parameter independence is violated or is satisfied. Now, conditional parameter independence. We said that intuitively it looks like it's prohibiting any direct influence of Alice's experimental context on Bob's result. But that's not the end of the story. I mean, because we are looking at it always in conjunction with parameter independence. And if we do that, given parameter independence, then conditional parameter independence, that was probability of B given A is independent of I. And, okay, said like that, the probability of Bob's result, given Alice's result, is independent of Alice's settings. That sounds like prohibiting any direct influence of Alice's settings on Bob's result. But given parameter independence, this condition is equivalent to still independent on I. And now this seems to have a completely different intuitive meaning. The intuitive meaning, so here, the probability of Alice's outcome given Bob's outcome is independent of Alice's settings. It looks like let me see. What does it look like?
Yes, that's exactly.
Well, this is, you know, somehow. The conditional probability. Let me see.
The way I read that expression is, suppose it's Alice's probability for A. Then if Alice were supplied with the value of the hidden variable and she were supplied with Bob's outcome, her probability for A would not depend upon which context she used. That's all it's saying.
But it looks like, if you say what it doesn't say, it looks like if she weren't supplied with Bob's outcome,
because it follows from parameter independence that it doesn't. But yeah, really, what it is, it's the joint probabilities are independent of I. And, you know, in fact, it's all three are independent of either context. This is the content of conditional parameter independence, given that parameter independence holds. It's much more difficult to get a handle on what this is. This is conditional parameter independence. Now, what happens if it is violated? So, if this were indeed dependent on I, by parameter independence, we know that if we average over B, it becomes independent of I. So, it depends on A, but the dependence on A depends on B. So it looks like, you know, both Alice's context and Bob's result influence Alice's outcome, but in a way that if you average over Bob's result, the influence Alice has on her outcome is washed out. That's how it looks. And that's very different from a prohibition of direct influence from Alice's setting to Bob's result. So it's a completely different intuitive picture, depending on which equivalent formulation you take. So, I mean, all of these seem to have something to do with something influencing something else on the other side, but it's hard to pin down what. So what we can say is it looks like a hidden variables theory that satisfies parameter independence but violates conditional parameter independence might have more trouble in coexisting peacefully with relativity than one that satisfies both parameter independence and conditional parameter independence. You know, if both of them are satisfied, then maybe, yes, we have peaceful coexistence. But if parameter independence satisfies but not conditional parameter independence, it's more like the drôle de guerre, before the Germans invaded France in 1940. It was war, but...
Phony war.
Yeah, the phony war. You know, they weren't shooting at each other, but it was war. Yeah, that's worse than peaceful coexistence. that's not peaceful coexistence, even if they're not shooting at each other.
That's certainly addressing my question, in fact, but I was hoping for another kind of answer. Maybe
I don't have it.
Maybe one visual to look for. This is a very sort of operational.
Mm-hmm.
Gets back maybe to Hansen's point. I mean, the original, I don't know what you call it, but stochastic independence, that's a kind of objective notion of causality. In the sense that it doesn't depend on distinguishing certain settings or operations. It's just saying that if there's only to the extent that there's a common cause in the past, can there be correlation? From that, you could derive all the other things. If you just accepted that.
But that's exactly what you don't expect.
Which he doesn't, right. So that's, I'm asking if it can be weakened.
If it can be changed in ways that it looks more like those kinds of requirements. I really have no idea. Sorry, no, I don't know. Don't know.
I mean, I think in a sense, maybe that's what quantum mechanics really does.
I don't know.
Thank Guido once again.
Thank you.